So I've talked a little bit about slide four already, right? But I didn't get quite all the way through it. We were talking about subatomic particles, the three major subatomic particles that make up atoms, protons, neutrons, and electrons. And protons and neutrons have a couple things in common. One is that those are the only kind of subatomic particles of the three that you find in the cell nucleus. So a cell nucleus consists of at least one proton, because if there's no proton, then you don't have a cell nucleus. I mean, an atomic nucleus. And maybe one or more neutrons, depending on the atom. And that's all you'll find there of the three. You don't find electrons there. Electrons you find not in the nucleus, but in the space around the nucleus somewhere. Not forming well-defined orbits like this cartoon implies. That's a lie. But each electron is somewhere in the space around the nucleus, and for reasons that are beyond the scope of this course, we can't actually tell for certain at any given moment where an electron is. We just know where they might be by probability. Another thing that neutrons and protons have in common is that they are almost identical mass, or they have almost identical mass. It's not exactly the same, but close enough for our purposes. An important difference, of course, between a neutron and a proton is that a neutron, as its name implies, is neutral electrically. It does not have a charge. Whereas a proton is a charged subatomic particle, and specifically, it is positively charged. Each proton individually exhibits a positive one charge. Electrons, another reason this is a lie, is the relative sizes of these. Electrons are way smaller than protons, much smaller than this picture implies. Only roughly a thousandth of the mass of a proton. But despite that huge disparity in size, an electron, which is also a charged particle, but negatively charged, an electron has a charge whose size is the same as the size of the charge of a proton. The particles themselves are different sizes, but the size of their charges is the same, the absolute value, in other words. Another way of saying that is that an individual proton has a positive one charge. An electron individually has a negative one charge that is just as big as a positive one charge, but in the other direction. And this is why if you have an equal number of protons and electrons, they will add up those charges to zero. And the overall atom will be neutral, electrostatically. In fact, that's what we mean when we talk about an atom. It's really shorthand for neutral atom. Because if the atom is not electrically neutral, which will happen if the number of protons does not equal the number of electrons, then we no longer call it an atom, even though it technically is. We give it a different name to indicate that it's charged overall. And what's the name for that? What do we call it when it's no longer neutral? We call it an ion. Much more about those in a second. More like a couple minutes. Another special thing about protons, beyond the fact that they're found only in the nucleus and that they are positively charged, is that the number of protons that an atom has, whatever that number is, entirely defines the element that atom is an example of. So we already talked about the fact that there are roughly 100 elements in the universe. And there is an unlimited number of compounds that we can make out of those 100 or so elements. Well, what was I getting here? What makes the 100 different elements different from each other is not that they're made up of different kinds of protons, neutrons, and electrons. Because any given proton is indistinguishable from any other proton. You can say the same thing about any given electron. All electrons are the same, all protons are the same as each other, all neutrons are the same as each other. So when we talk about a different kind of atom, which a different element is made up of, it's made up of the same exact kinds of subatomic particles, but what matters is the number of protons. And that's the only thing that matters. That's what I mean when I said the number of protons completely defines the element type. And if you look at the periodic table, each element has, of course, its unique symbol. But in the upper right-hand corner of the box, you see an integer, whereas the numbers below it are not integers. The blue numbers, though, they're whole numbers. And those are individually called atomic numbers. Each element has its own atomic number. Notice that the periodic table is an orderly arrangement of the elements in order of their atomic number, starting with 1. Well, the atomic number is the number of protons that that type of atom has. And so when I said that the number of protons entirely defines the element, what I mean, for instance, is that lithium, element number 3, an atom of lithium, is an atom of lithium only because there are exactly 3 protons in that atom, regardless of how many electrons and neutrons might be there. It's the number of protons that defines the element. But when we say an atom of lithium, by which we really imply a neutral atom of lithium, that means that there also are 3 electrons, simply because it has to have 3 protons to be lithium, and therefore it has to have 3 electrons to be overall neutral, because you have to have as many negatives as positives to add up to 0. All right? You can change the number of electrons, though, without changing it from being lithium, because the number of protons is the only thing that matters. So, atoms can form ions. They don't have to stay as neutral atoms. And if you think about it, since there are 2 different charged particle types, protons and electrons, you would think that there's 4 ways of going about creating an ion. An ion is anything that has a non-zero charge. It has either a positive or a negative charge. And there aren't 4 ways, but you can think about 4 ways that that could happen. You could either add protons, subtract protons, add electrons, or subtract electrons. But changes in the number of protons don't happen under normal chemical reactions. So that's not how atoms ionize. In other words, the number of protons stays put. And when an atom of that type, whatever element it is, becomes an ion, it becomes an ion of that same element because the number of protons doesn't change. And there's 2 ways that can happen. You can either add electrons to that atom or subtract electrons from it. Either one is going to cause a non-zero total number of charges, right? If a neutral atom takes on additional electrons, what's going to happen to its overall charge? If you add electrons to a neutral atom, what happens to the overall charge? It becomes negative, because now you have just as many negatives as there were positive, plus an additional electron or more. Right? More negatives than positives, in other words, so overall negative. But you could also take away 1 or more electrons that the neutral atom already has. And now you don't have enough electrons to neutralize the number of protons that are still there. So you have more positives than negatives, and the overall ion is positive. So these two ways give us two categories of ions. Overall, they're all ions if they're charged. They're not neutral atoms, they're ions. But there are two categories. Cations are ions that are positively charged. Therefore, any given cation has fewer electrons than protons. Negatively charged ions are specifically called anions. An anion has more electrons than protons. Yeah. An anion is negatively charged by virtue of the fact that it has more electrons, more negative charges, than protons, positive charges. Now, ion starts with I, and I don't want you to confuse that with another word that we use that starts with I, which is isotope. It's a completely different thing. Ions have to do with changes in the number of electrons, one way or the other. That's not what an isotope is at all. I lied to you a bit. Last time I think I said this. When we defined an element as a substance made up of only one kind of atom, what I mean by one kind of atom is that every one of those atoms has the same number of protons and therefore is defined as that type of element only. But really, there are different versions of each of the element types. Yeah.
Sorry if I missed this. So what was the definition of just a plain ion?
Just ion.
Yeah, just ion.
It's just a charged particle, an atom that has either lost or gained electrons.
Okay.
And therefore, its overall charge is non-zero. Okay, so the number of protons is what determines the element type, right? So, for instance, calcium, number 20 here, is calcium only because it has 20 protons. It's the only thing that matters. And that won't change. But you could have some number of neutrons in there, and however many neutrons you have doesn't change the fact that it's calcium. Right? Because that's not the number of neutrons. It has nothing to do with the number of protons. And there are different versions of calcium because some atoms have a certain number of neutrons in addition to those 20 protons. Other versions have a different number of neutrons in addition to those same 20 protons. That's what isotopes are. Atoms of the same element, and therefore having the same number of protons, but differing in the number of neutrons. And if an isotope has greater number of neutrons compared to another isotope of that same element, that means it's still the same element, but it's more massive. It has additional particles in it. So it acts a little bit differently because of that extra mass. But those are isotopes. That has nothing to do with changing the charge, right? And ionizing, because neutrons, by definition, they got their name because they are neutral. They don't change the charge. Okay, now, let's go on to slide 5. Look at a different representation in A compared to the one that we've been looking at, which is B. I told you that B is a lie. Well, A is also a lie for various reasons, one of which is protons are not really magenta. It's just a cartoon, obviously. But what's better about A than B is that it doesn't show electrons occurring in these defined orbits, which they don't really occur in. Instead, electrons are found somewhere in the space around the atomic nucleus. And I say somewhere because moment to moment we can't really know with certainty where they are. All we can do is probabilistically or mathematically predict where they might be with greater frequency compared to somewhere else. And that's represented in this figure by how deeply yellow this electron cloud, as it's called, is. So the more yellow it is, the more likely it's going to be there at any given moment. And it fades out to white because it becomes less and less likely that you'll find an electron out there. It is possible still, though. All right, so that's the idea of an electron cloud. Six. Now we need, speaking of the space around a nucleus, we need to talk about spaces in more depth. These spaces that we're talking about, and there's different names for different spaces, are not structures, it's important to understand. They're not made out of anything, they're just spaces in the volume that's around an atomic nucleus. So these spaces are places where electrons might be found. All right? They're not structures. Well, there are spaces of different sizes, and we're going to subdivide them into smaller spaces that are contained within the larger space. Just like an overall house is a space, and you can think of the subspaces as the rooms within that space. The big spaces, the biggest of the three spaces we're going to talk about, are called energy levels. That's one name that you can use. An interchangeable word means the same thing, is shell or electron shell. And those are represented in this figure six by these yellowish circles at greater and greater distances from the atomic nucleus. Okay, so these energy levels are just named with numbers, starting with one for the energy level that, or the space that's closest to the atomic nucleus. So this is energy level one, energy level two, and so on. But they're just spaces, they're not actual structures. Electrons occupy these shells, though. Electrons can be in a shell, or they can be in another shell, a higher energy level, for instance. If an electron gets put into a higher energy level, it contains more energy, which is why that's not going to happen unless you provide the energy to make it go up an energy level. And conversely, if an electron is at a higher energy level and drops down to a lower one, that releases energy. Because energy can't be created or destroyed. It just moves around. Okay? Yeah.
Do only electrons reside in there?
Yes. Protons and neutrons are confined to the nucleus. That's where they'll stay put. And they define the nucleus. Another important thing about these levels, though, is that any given electron is in one level or another. It's not ever halfway between levels. Which is exactly what this staircase cartoon is all about by analogy. If you roll a ball from the top step, it might make it all the way down, it might land on one of the steps, but it's never going to stop halfway between steps. Right? No matter how many times you try it. In other words, we say that the energy levels are discrete. It's either one or the other, or an other, I should say, because there's more than two. Okay? Now, that is the largest of the three spaces we're going to talk about. But each shell, which is itself just a space, is made up of spaces within it that are called subshells. Now, those subshells are still just spaces, but subshells are spaces within shells. And just like shells are subdivided into subshells, we also subdivide subshells into still other spaces. Those spaces that make up subshells are called orbitals or electron orbitals. And orbitals are also just spaces. They're not actual material things. Everyone with me so far? Now you see several different orbitals here in this diagram overlaid. But don't worry about the diagram so much yet until we talk about these more. There are different types of orbitals, and there are different types of subshells. Okay? A subshell, which is part of a level, right? Subshell is a space within the shell or level. A subshell consists of all of the orbitals of a particular type, however many there are. Now, talking about different orbital types, there are what are called S orbitals. And you see two of them here, actually, because what we see here are the spaces that make up the first two shells or energy levels for this atom. Well, you see two circles here. The smaller and darker circle is the S orbital. All S's are spherical in shape, but the smallest one is the S orbital that is found in the S subshell of energy level or shell 1. And energy level or shell 1 is kind of a special case, because energy level 1, which is itself a space, is made up of only one subshell, the S subshell, which itself is made up of only one orbital, a single S orbital. Okay, so really for level 1, the S orbital, the S subshell, and the entire shell are really all the same space, just different names for them. It's like having a box within a box within a box, but all the boxes are the same size. And that, since this S, though, occurs in the first level, we call it the 1S orbital. Now, I said a little bit ago that a subshell consists of all the orbitals of the same type. Well, in energy level 1, there's only one S orbital, so the S subshell consists of all one of that, in a sense, and therefore the S subshell is really the same thing as the S orbital. Now, so that's the only subshell that you have in shell 1, because S's are the only orbitals that are in shell 1. There's only one of them. I shouldn't say S's. There's no other type of orbital in shell 1, so there's no other type of subshell. Is that all clear? Now let's go up to energy level 2, or shell 2. 2 and higher, when you get to 2 and beyond, they, just like energy level 1, or shell 1, have an S subshell, but it's a different one compared to the lower levels. And for each individual level, the S subshell in that level consists of only one S orbital. Only a single S orbital, not the numeral 1. Okay? So this small circle is the only orbital that makes up the level 1's S subshell. And therefore it makes up the entire shell, because that's the only subshell in the first shell. The second shell has its own S subshell, which also contains only one S orbital. Only a single S orbital, I should say, because since that's in the second shell, the bigger circle, we call it the 2S orbital. But in addition to the S orbital that every shell has, there are also P orbitals, so-called P orbitals, starting with level 2 and beyond. And remember that a subshell consists of all the orbitals of the same type, right? Go ahead. Starting with shell 2. Yeah, so 2, 3, and beyond, but not 1. But the subshell, any given subshell contains all of the orbitals of the same type in that level. Well, for levels that have p orbitals, there are 3 different p orbitals in that level. And those are the ones that are dumbbell shaped in this picture. And these shapes are real. Remember, they're not structures, but they are mathematical probability clouds where the electrons might be found. So they actually have a shape, even though they're a space. And the S ones are spherical, but the P ones are shaped like an infinity symbol, or it's kind of a dumbbell shape. And you can see that there are 3 of them. This is one. Here's another one. And here's the third one. What you don't really get a good picture of in a 2D image is that these 3 P orbitals that occur in the same level are mutually orthogonal, which is just a mathematical word that means each one of them is arranged at right angles to the other 2. So they're the axis that goes through the length of them, each axis is like the 3 axes of a 3-dimensional graph, x, y, and z. So you have one of them arranged this way, another one at right angles to that, and then another one at right angles to both of those. That's what that's trying to depict. But they're all 3 of them, even though they're distinct orbitals, they're all P orbitals. Therefore, all 3 of them together make up the P subshell of level 2. But remember that level 2 also has an S subshell that consists of an S orbital. Is all that clear? So we have a total of how many orbitals here in this picture? 5. We have 5 total orbitals. How many shells? 2 shells, 1 and 2. How many subshells? 3 subshells. We have the S subshell of level 1. We have the S subshell of level 2. And we have a P subshell of level 2. And that P subshell contains all 3 of the different P orbitals in that level. Since there are 3 different Ps and they are mutually orthogonal to each other, we specify them with subscripts X, Y, and Z. And since these don't occur in the first, there's no such thing as a 1PX or a 1PY. But you do have a 2PX, a 2PY, and a 2PZ. All 3 of those make up the P subshell of level 2. You see how it works there? So that shows, this is an exhaustive list of all 5 of these orbitals. A really important thing about orbitals that I don't think I've said yet is that any individual orbital, regardless of the type, can contain at most 2 electrons. which means there are exactly three possibilities for any given orbital. The three possibilities are that it contains two electrons, it contains one electron, or it contains zero electrons. No other possibilities. Okay? Now remember that the first energy level is the lowest energy. And so if they can, electrons want to occupy the lowest energy level, because that's more stable. So think about building an atom. First of all, to have an atom, you have to have an atomic nucleus. So you have to, let's start with the simplest possibility, just a single proton, which by definition is element number one, hydrogen, just by having the proton. It's a neutral atom, though. So to make it neutral, we have to have in addition to the proton, have an electron. What I'm saying here is that the electron is not going to occupy level 6 or level 2 even. It's going to occupy the lowest energy level that's available. Since it's just one electron, it will fit in the first energy level. How many electrons can fit total in energy level 1? Two. Because energy level 1 contains only one subshell, the S subshell, which itself contains only one orbital, the 1S orbital. That means the entire shell is made up of just one orbital. And any orbital can hold at most two. So, if you think of helium, the next element, what makes it helium is that it has two protons, but if you have two electrons to make it neutral, you put them both in the first energy level, specifically in the 1s orbital, which is the only orbital in that shell, and that fills the shell up entirely. It can't hold any more, right? Well, that's a special situation. Having a full outer shell gives the atom stability. So in a sense, that atom is nice and happy the way things are and does not want to change anything. So it's not going to interact with other atoms, including atoms of the same type. In other words, it's not going to form compounds with other kinds of atoms. It's not going to undergo chemical reactions with other things. This brings up something I don't remember whether I said or not, so I'll say it. Now, the periodic table has rows and columns, of course, but we don't call them rows or columns. We call the columns groups. And what's special about any given group or column is that all of the elements, however many there are, in that same group have similar chemical properties. For instance, helium, which I mentioned, is in the same group with neon and argon and krypton and so on. Those collectively are known as the noble gases. They're all happy. They all have in common that they have an outer shell that's full. And that makes them stable already. They don't have to undergo chemical reactions to become more stable. They're as stable as they can be right now. The left edge, group 1, are not as stable. And neither are any of the other ones until you get to that right edge. But the things within group 1 are similar to each other, even though they're different elements. They act similarly chemically. Rows, on the other hand, are called periods. It's the periodic table, and periodic means repeating. All right, like a sine wave has a period that repeats. As you go across a period from right to left to right, you go to different elements that have pretty different properties until you get all the way through the period. Then when you start a new period, you'll get another pattern of those properties because you're going back through the group, the same groups again, and groups have similar properties. And that's why it's arranged the way it is. Periods, by the way, the rows, represent energy levels. Now notice that period one is unlike the others. It has only two elements in it. Why? Knowing what I just told you, that the first period represents energy level one, why are there only two elements in that? Because energy level one is made up of only one orbital total, which means it can't hold any more than two electrons. Two is the most, and therefore it's full and happy like helium. Okay, now think about this next one, lithium. It has three protons, that's what makes it lithium, but it has three electrons if it's neutral. The first two of those fill up energy level one. You still have an electron to go, though. So that has to go somewhere in energy level two, in one of the four different orbitals that are in energy level two. Okay? But notice that there are eight different elements in period two. Because if you think of this second energy level, which contains two subshells, a P and an S subshell, but they feature a total of four orbitals, three P's and an S, and each individual orbital can hold two. That means the four total orbitals in the second level can hold a total of maximum eight electrons. And that's why, that's the basis of the so-called octet rule in chemistry. That's why eight is a special number. Not for the first period, though, because there's only one orbital in that shell. In the second shell, there are four orbitals, and therefore eight possible numbers of electrons. Eight elements. And as you go from lithium on the left, rightward in that second period, what you really are looking at are atoms, because of their numbers of electrons, that are becoming fuller and fuller with respect to shell two. Until you finally get to neon, which is completely full in its outer shell, and that's what makes it stable. Alright, does all that make sense? Let's look at a different picture in slide 8 of these orbitals, but now they're no longer superimposed. You can see them individually. Well, the 1s orbital is the only orbital in the 1s subshell, which is the only subshell in the first level. That's the entire thing. So really, first level, 1s subshell, and 1s orbital are just different names for the same things. But in the second level, you have four different orbitals spread out in two subshells. The S subshell contains all of the S orbitals, but there's only one of them. The P subshell contains all of the P orbitals, and there are three of them. And that, the fact that each of them individually can hold two is why eight is a special number in the octet number, in the octet rule. Two in the S and two in each of the three P's. Okay, now to 9. This is just a brief, or just a piece of the periodic table, namely the top part, only the first few periods. You can see that the shells correspond to periods here. mainly because in biology, the chemistry that happens that is life and the things that make up organisms are these comparatively lighter or less massive atoms or elements near the top of the periodic table. The heavy stuff, like I said earlier, is stuff that'll kill you if, depending on what it is, if it's in your body. So all the important stuff that happens within cells involves these ones near the top. And these little circles that you see around each nucleus, those, what does an individual circle here represent? A shell, not a subshell, not an orbital. You should know that it can't be an orbital because some of them have more than two dots in them, which are electrons, right? That's impossible. And they're not subshells either. They're the entire shell consisting of some number of subshells, which consist in turn in some number of orbitals. But the second one can hold eight, and that's the octet rule. And that's usually the period that we're concerned with because the atoms in that are the ones that make up organisms. Now, there's hydrogen. Another special thing about hydrogen, well, actually, before I even say that, let me say that overall, the periodic table, which is all the elements, of course, can be broken into two major groups, metals and nonmetals. And the majority of elements are metals. So it's not a 50-50 split. This periodic table doesn't show it, but a lot of them you'll see a different color that's kind of like a stair step going down right here. The metals are the things to the left of that, which is most elements, like I said. And then the ones that are above this, upper right, are the nonmetals. Far fewer nonmetals than metals. But hydrogen is a special case. Just, it's in the group one because it has one proton and one electron in its shell. But despite being over here with the left where all the metals are, hydrogen is classified as a nonmetal, which will be important when we start talking about bonds. Okay, so all the other ones on the left besides hydrogen are metals. Okay, now let's talk about chemical bonds. Bonds in general, because there's more than just chemical bonds. Bonds hold things together. Of course, that's the definition of a bond. But not all bonds are chemical bonds. A chemical bond is a bond that, if it happens, actually changes the chemical you have. In other words, you're talking about different stuff if a chemical bond forms. In our first example of a chemical reaction, which was sodium and chlorine reacting to form sodium chloride, sodium chloride isn't sodium or chlorine. It's different stuff. And that happens only if the bond that forms is a chemical bond. Later we'll talk about hydrogen bonds, for instance. They're not chemical bonds because it doesn't change the stuff that you have. Okay, but back to chemical bonds. There are three major categories of chemical bonds that we need to go through. The first of which, pictured here, is ionic bonds. Now, ionic is simply the adjective of ion, so ions must be involved. And in fact, this example is specifically the example we already used as a chemical reaction example. Sodium and chlorine reacting to form sodium chloride. New stuff. The product is different. But this is an ionic bond, and therefore ions are involved. And let me just say, not just this example, but in all cases of ionic bonds, the two things that are bonded are one metal and one nonmetal. I shouldn't necessarily say one, but it is metals and nonmetals that get together in ionic bonds. Now, that's not to say that a metal can't react with another metal, or form bonds, I should say. But those are different kinds of bonds. Those are metallic bonds. And also, nonmetals can form bonds with other nonmetals, but those are the second category we'll look at, which are covalent bonds. In an ionic bond, a metal and a nonmetal are reacting. Now here, we have sodium and chlorine, the original players, the reactants. And if you look up sodium, it's number 11. Notice it's in group 1. It's a metal. But not only is it a metal, it's a metal on the extreme left edge. The reason it's on that left edge, just like the other ones in the same group, is that there is only one electron in its outer shell. Right? In other words, it has one more electron than the nice, stable, noble gas that came right before it. There wasn't room for another one, so you had to put it into another shell. Now, this brings up, temporarily, before we get back to the particulars of this, another definition or two. I just used the word valence.
Maybe I didn't yet. But I need to talk about the word valence, which we use in different ways. So be careful with the word.
You have to. Its meaning depends on its context. So one use of the word is in the phrase valence shell, which just means the outermost shell that has at least one electron in it. So the shells exist as spaces, numbered one through whatever. But if there aren't if you get so far away to a higher level that there aren't even any electrons in it, then we just ignore those. For any given atom, there is one shell that is outermost and that has at least one electron in it. That's called the valence shell. And that's really important in chemical reactions for what hopefully makes common sense. Based on what you know about how atoms are built out of the subatomic particles, if two atoms come together, they meet each other, it's not the atomic nuclei that contact each other, right? They're deeper. It's the electrons that are occupying the clouds outside of the nuclei that come into contact. And so that's what chemical reactions involve, a rearrangement of electrons, and specifically, electrons in valence shells. Because if there are multiple shells for an atom that have atoms, electrons in them, the lower energy levels are also not going to meet each other, right? It's the outer ones, the valence shells, that come into contact. Okay, so that's one use of the word valence. We can also talk about valence electrons, which are simply any electrons that are in the valence shell, however many there are. Okay, that's straightforward enough, I think. But we can also talk about an atom's valence, which is a little different. An atom's valence is the number of additional electrons it would require to fill the valence shell for that atom. So the valence of an atom, first of all, is a number. But it's a number of additional electrons that it does not have, but that you would have to add in order to fill the valence shell, which, by the way, would make it nice and happy, like one of these stable, noble gases. That's why it's a special number. Okay, so those are different uses of the word valence. And the valence, as the last definition, the number, the valence, is particularly important for covalent bonds, which we haven't gotten to yet. But we'll get back to that. Now let's continue on the discussion of ionic bonds. I just told you that an ionic bond forms between a metal and a nonmetal, and the metals are the ones on the left side, the nonmetals are in the upper right. Thinking about periods the way we've been talking about them, namely the farther right you get, the more filled that shell is, that valence shell, that means that nonmetals are atoms that are more full in their valence shell than they are empty. Right? And how full they are, you can practically think of as how close are they to this left, to this right edge. The right edge, they are full, that's why they're not going to react with anything. But chlorine and fluorine, they're just one step away. That's nonmetals. Metals, on the other hand, are more empty than they are full in their valence shells. Any given element, other than the noble gases that are already satisfied, would like to get to the nice stable condition that noble gases have. In other words, they would like to get to the situation in which their valence shell is full. But metals and nonmetals approach that stability differently. Now, look at this sodium atom. It's number 11 element, so it has 11 protons that aren't shown in the nucleus. That means, to begin with, the neutral atom has 11 electrons as well, right? Two of those fill up shell 1. 8 more fill up the 4 orbitals of shell 2. That's 10 total. And it has just one more, which is why it's in group 1. It has one more than the one that came before it, which is a noble gas. That's mostly empty, not mostly full, in the valence shell. Well, if it simply loses that one electron that's in its current valence shell, that outer shell will be totally empty. And therefore, we don't even consider it anymore when it's empty. That means its new valence shell would be shell 2, which is already full. So being mostly empty rather than mostly full, metals gain stability by forming ions by losing electrons. In other words, by forming specifically cations, positively charged ions. In other words, and specifically sodium, number 11, is becoming stable by becoming like number 10, argon, by dropping down a valence shell. Just the opposite for nonmetals. They are more full than empty, just like chlorine here, because they're closer to the right edge than the left. Chlorine is number 17, there's 17 protons, 17 electrons. 2 fill up the first shell, 8 more fill up the second. That leaves 7, which is almost all the way to the 8 that can fill up this next subshell. And therefore, if you have one of each of these, a sodium and a chlorine, sodium is willing to give up one electron, and chlorine is equally willing to take it, because that's going to satisfy both of them valence-wise. Right? It's going to leave them with a nice, full, outer subshell. And that's why it happens. So an ionic bond is formed when there is a transfer of electrons from one participant to the other. More or less permanent transfer. What I mean is that electron is going to be, in this case, no longer the property of sodium. It's going to be fully the property of chlorine. And the one that transfers the electron to the other is the metal. The one that receives the electron from the other is the nonmetal, for reasons we just got done talking about. But notice that transfer of one electron from one to the other simultaneously forms two different ions. And specifically, two different categories of ions. Because one of them loses an electron and therefore becomes positively charged, since it doesn't have enough negatives to make up for the protons. And the other that receives the electron, the nonmetal, becomes a negatively charged ion because now it has one more negative than positive. Each one by itself is an ion, but one's a cation, one's an anion, and they therefore have opposite electrostatic charge overall, and that opposite charge is what causes them to attract each other. That's the basis for the attractive force of an ionic bond. Yeah?
Will it ever happen where they're transferring more than one electron?
Yes. Specifically in the case of beryllium, for example. It has two in its outer shell. And I'm glad you said this because I want to say this a different way. The metals, since they are more empty than full, want to lose their electrons to become stable. Because in the case of beryllium, it's much easier to lose two than it is to gain six. And if you have beryllium and oxygen is two steps away from being full, so it would gladly take both of those from it. Because you add the two to the six valence electrons oxygen has, and it makes it happy. So yes, it's not just always one. It is always one, though, for that first group. Yeah.
So with that being said, is it metal to non-metal in ionic bonds?
Yes, always.
Always?
Yes. If it's metal and metal, that's a different kind of bond called a metallic bond, and I'm not even going to talk about it other than to name it. If it's non-metal with non-metal, that's a covalent bond, which we'll get to next. Not for non-metal to metal is the same as metal to non-metal.
Okay.
I'm just saying one of each is going to make an ionic bond. Now, you can see this in pictorial form. Both of them are happy now because they have a valence shell that's full. Makes them individually stable, but now that they're ionized in opposite charge directions, that's what keeps them together. And it's not a very strong bond, but it is much stronger than non-chemical bonds, which is why you no longer have sodium and chlorine, you have sodium chloride, different stuff. Another way of saying that it's a chemical bond. All right? There's such a thing, though. Let's go to 11 first. When this happens, well, in the previous slide, we saw this happen for just a single metal atom and a single non-metal atom, which can occur, of course, but usually there's trillions and trillions of each of the kind. Let me just go back to the previous one for a second, though. If it happens with just one of each, though, they're attracted to each other because they're opposite charges. But this sodium is positive. It looks positive from all directions. And the chloride, which the nonmetals change their name. It's not chlorine anymore. It's chloride ion. Anyway, it's negative in all directions. So if you have other sodium ions, they will be attracted to all sides of the chlorine or the chloride. And if you have more chlorides, they'll be attracted to all sides of the sodium. Which is why, if you have multiple ions instead of just one of each, they will form indefinitely big crystals. There is no defined size, in other words. A crystal can be as big as you want, just depends on how many individual ions you have. This is another way of saying that, well, it's not another way of saying it, but there is no such thing as a molecule of an ionic compound. We sometimes say that, using the word molecule, but these are not molecules that are forming here. Ionic bonds form ionic compounds which don't have a definite size. When we mine, and by the way, ionic compounds in general are called salts. This is just one of many, many different kinds of salt. When we typically day-to-day say salt, we're talking about table salt, sodium chloride, but there's all kinds of salts. If it's metal and non-metal, it's a salt. And salts don't come in molecules. Salts can be as big as you want. When you mine for sodium chloride, which is how we get table salt at the table finally, someone's mining it, the crystals are bigger than buildings. Because of this fact that the charge is attracting the opposite ion from all directions. Okay, does that all make sense? That's different, though, from a molecule. A molecule has a definite size. Like water, for instance, is a molecule. Now, you have trillions and trillions of water molecules in a tiny drop, but they are not connected to each other like the ions are in an ionic compound. So each individual H2O is its own thing. That is a particular size. Now, on an ionic compound, there's no limit to how big it can be, but there is a limit to how small it can be, obviously, right? In this case, the smallest it could be for sodium chloride is to have exactly one sodium ion and one chloride ion. If you take away either of those, you no longer have sodium chloride, right? So it's as small as it can be. That's not a molecule, though. That is called a formula unit. Formula unit is the smallest piece of a salt or ionic compound that you could have and still have the same properties, the same substance. All right, now we can go on to the second major category of bonds. I keep forgetting that clock is totally wrong. So I have about 13 minutes or so. Is that right?
Yeah.
The second major category is covalent bonds. Now notice the word. It has valent in it, form of valence. And the co prefix means share, just as co-stars share the lead in a movie. Well, this is a different way of forming a bond, obviously. I said that an ionic bond is formed when there is a transfer of electron or more from one to another, permanent, more or less. That's not what happens in a covalent bond. Instead, there is sharing of electrons in a covalent bond. It's not a one-way transfer. And importantly, it's a sharing of a pair or some number of pairs of electrons. So a single electron doesn't get shared in a covalent bond. The simplest possibility is for two electrons, one pair, to be shared. And the reason that is the simplest possibility is because there has to be mutual sharing. In other words, each of the two atoms involved shares one of its electrons with the other. And so there are two that are shared by the pair of atoms. All right? Now, this happens basically, if you want to think about it in anthropomorphic terms, the two hydrogen atoms that we're starting at in this example in slide 12, neither one of them is happy. They're not at the right edge, right? They want to be like helium. They're hydrogen, so they have one proton and therefore one electron, but one is only halfway filled. The octet rule doesn't apply to level one, right? Because level one contains only one total orbital, and therefore 2 is the magic number for the first period. Right? So what is hydrogen's valence? It's not 2. What is the valence in general, not just for hydrogen? What's the definition of the valence of an atom? The number of additional electrons that it doesn't currently have that you would have to give it to make its valence shell full. Well, the valence shell for hydrogen is shell 1, which can hold only 2 at most. It has 1 already. You therefore have to give it 1 more to make it happy. That's why its valence is 1. Oxygen, which is not on this picture, but look at it where it is, 2 steps away from neon. It's in this group because it has, like the other things in that group, 6 valence electrons. 2 non-valence electrons in the lower shell. 6 valence electrons in a shell that can hold 2 more. Right? Because that second shell can hold 8. Therefore, oxygen's valence is 2. Because you would have to give it 2 more to make it just like the noble gas, having a full shell. Now, the valence, which is the number of an atom, you can also practically think of as the number of covalent bonds that that atom needs to make in order to be satisfied. Here's why, though. Here's the basis of a covalent bond using hydrogen as an example. So this is an example, first of all, of a reaction between 2 nonmetals. Because remember, hydrogen, despite being on the left, is a nonmetal. And I've already told you that a nonmetal with another nonmetal is going to form a covalent bond, not an ionic bond. And the reason it's a covalent bond with a sharing of electrons is because, being 2 nonmetals, they're both mostly full. Neither one of them wants to lose electrons, right? They're both mostly full, so they really both want to gain electrons. They can't fully do that because electrons can't just pop into existence. You only have so many to work with. But if the 2 hydrogen atoms in this case make a deal with each other in which each hydrogen atom says, I'll share my 1 electron with you if you share your 1 electron with me, then both individual atomic nuclei, both atoms, actually get credit for both of the shared electrons, or for the 1 pair of shared electrons. It's like they each have 2 electrons, even though there are only 2 between them. And that's because instead of being transferred, that pair of electrons spends time around each of the 2 atomic nuclei, which makes it like each individual hydrogen has both electrons, which makes it nice and happy like helium. Okay, so the valence of each individual hydrogen is 1. It needs credit for 1 more. Well, it gets credit for an additional 1 coming from the pair that are shared, filling its valence, satisfying its valence. But remember, I said that the valence is also, you can think of as the number of bonds it's going to make. But when hydrogen makes covalent bonds, it's going to make exactly 1. Because that's all, it only needs 1 more electron. If oxygen is involved in a covalent bond, it's going to make exactly 2. Because its valence is 2. Okay? And that's exactly what it does in the case of water, by the way. H2O is 1 oxygen simultaneously bonded to each of 2 hydrogens. Each individual hydrogen is forming 1 bond, but the oxygen is forming 2 bonds. Everyone is satisfied. And the last thing I want to say about the covalent bonds compared to ionic bonds is that though they're both chemical bonds, because you're turning it into different stuff, covalent bonds are much stronger than ionic bonds, meaning that the atoms are held together much more strongly, meaning that it takes a lot more energy to break those bonds than it does to break ionic bonds. And I want to repeat, I think I've said this already, but I want to make sure that you get this. It's only nonmetals forming bonds with nonmetals, covalent bonds, that forms what we properly call molecules. Right? If it's a metal and a nonmetal, you're not forming covalent bonds, you're forming ionic bonds, and that can be any size. It's not a predefined size. It's not a molecule. Molecules are particles, whether they're compounds or elements, they're particles made by forming covalent bonds. And by the way, that last thing I just said, whether they're compounds or not, this is an example in this figure of a covalent bond forming a molecule, but that molecule is still an element. It's different stuff. It's a hydrogen molecule versus hydrogen atoms, but it's still elemental because it's nothing but hydrogen. If you use two or more different nonmetals, like hydrogen and oxygen, for instance, then it's not only a covalent bonds, it's covalent bonds that are forming, and it's therefore not only a molecule, but it's specifically a molecular compound because it's made up of multiple element types. All right, so in 13, I guess they went a little longer than I said the last thing. I just quickly want to say about 13, though, that these little figures are called electron dot diagrams. And in a dot diagram, you use the chemical symbol from the periodic table, so H for hydrogen, O for oxygen, for instance. That symbol represents the nucleus, even though you don't show any protons or neutrons. And then as dots around that, indicating the space around the nucleus, those represent electrons. But, importantly, you don't necessarily put all the electrons down. In the case of hydrogen, you do, but just by coincidence. The only dots you put in an electron dot diagram are valence electrons. But in the case of hydrogen, its valence electron is the only electron it has. Oxygen is different, though. Oxygen has, being element number 10, I mean 8, 8 overall electrons, but only 6 valence electrons, right? Because its first two electrons fill up that first shell. Those are non-valence electrons. They're not going to involve themselves with chemical reactions. They're going to stay on that oxygen. The 6 valence electrons are the only 6 that you make dots for. And when you're filling this thing out, you put individual dots into different orbitals. There's a top, bottom, left, and right, the 4 sides of the oxygen. Those represent the 4 overall orbitals in shell 2, its valence shell. 3 P's and an S, right? And there are 6 valence electrons to work with. You would start, if you were doing this by hand, putting one here, one here, one here, one here. You still have 2 more to go, and so then you start pairing them up. These pairs represent full orbitals, and those will stay on the oxygen. They're not going to be involved in covalent sharing. These unpaired electrons are the ones that need to be satisfied, basically. And you can see here that oxygen has a valence of 2. It has to deal with the fact that it has 2 orbitals that are half filled. It needs to fill them. Okay, that's enough for today.